Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes on the Zero Point Radio Show through BBS Radio. It is July 25th, 2011. And I'm on with my co-host, James Moffitt, from Toronto, Ontario. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. How are you, Chris?
Okay. I'm struggling. I realized today, it's 7 weeks as of yesterday that Karen passed. So I was thinking, 7 weeks. So 7 times 7, 49 planes of existence. And today's the 50th day. So it's like 50 days since Karen passed. And, struggling with it all. So anyway, I really feel ready to, at one point I said that we were going to do a tribute series to Karen, and we kind of started part of that, but I think I need more time to consider that and put that together over the next month or so. So I don't think we'll follow up with that today, but rather explore some other areas. Before I forget, I did want to mention, and I forgot in our last show, I wanted to mention that I'm on the Don Nikoloff show, Evident Footprints, this Thursday evening at 1 a.m. in the morning. So it's actually Friday morning, but I count it as Thursday night anyway. I'll be on the Don Nikoloff show. Last time I was on the show, Jim, 2 weeks ago, I was reading some of that material that came through me back in August 11th of 2006, and I was reading some of that on the air. It kind of brings back a lot from that period of time that was just subsequent to Karen and I having such a rude awakening when we kind of learned of the deceit of 9/11 and kind of what that set off in both of us. And at some point in the future, I'd like to go back to that material and go through a little bit of what we went through during that period. But I don't really want to do that at this point and don't quite feel ready for that. So I thought instead that I'd... couple things today. I thought today, Jim, we haven't opened the telephone lines up for a long time, so I thought, why don't we open up the lines today? And we've certainly given months and months of material, so there may be people out there with questions or comments about different things we discuss. So why don't we just open the show up from the beginning of the show, and we'll accommodate anyone who comes in with any kind of question. And I'll just give out the number. The BBS toll-free number is 888-815-9756. So we'll take calls at any point through the show today. I thought I'd begin. I've been doing some new reading lately, Jim, and I started reading The Shock Doctrine book by Naomi Klein. Have you heard of that or read that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know Naomi Klein. Yeah.
What a shocking book. read that book. And chapter 2 on it was all about that ooing Cameron, a psychiatrist in Montreal at the hospital, and all the kind of experimentation they had done on subjects for the CIA and for the kind of intelligence community. Absolutely horrible, horrible things that they did to people.
Yeah.
I guess to some extent it later came out, and I understand a number of the victims were able to sue and get compensation and such, as though that compensates them for in any way for what was done to them in their lives. It's funny, it was an odd book because I was shocked by that second chapter about where she's actually talking about shock therapy and that being used by the CIA as a way of it was like they thought if you shock people enough, you kind of erase their memories, and then they wanted to kind of get back to having a person like break down their character structure, and so it's a tabula rasa again, kind of a clear slate, and then they thought they could kind of reprogram people and condition people, and I guess through that means try to develop some of their robot bunnies or whatever they desire.
A lot of that work came out of the Korean War and the idea of breaking people down and programming them, and the Manchurian Candidate idea. There was Army intelligence did a lot of work on that particular subject and after Korea. That's my understanding. I know Lloyd Strickland used to talk about that there were actually Army hearings and tapes that he had listened to that talked about that quite extensively.
Yeah, that's what it says in the book, too, that after the Korean War, they'd wanted to kind of investigate the Chinese and Korean methods of brainwashing, which seemed to have been so effective, kind of.
That was the interest in LSD, too, was they did a lot of research on LSD, too, as a substance that, they were looking at all sorts of different substances that you could use to, as you say, sort of erase people's personalities or turn them into, program them or deprogram them and break down their defenses if you're interrogating them. I'm sure that research has probably become very interesting to people again in recent times.
Yeah, it's so horrifying that we have these kind of police and intelligence communities who undertake these kinds of torture processes. You just think of the kind of horror show that they have going on at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Like, and if you look back and you just think of all those kind of poor Muslim and men kind of incarcerated there and picked up from the Middle East and taken there and kind of interrogated and tortured. Until they come up with one character who kind of claims that he masterminded 9/11, like it's just so ludicrous. It's just so horrible. I can't imagine what these people go through, the torture. And the whole time, like, Muslims had nothing to do with 9/11. Like, the whole thing was a fraud from the very beginning. And we have these kind of torture programs and rendition programs that go on around the world. It's just terrible. It's such flagrant violation of, like, Nuremberg standards and international law and the Geneva Accords. It's like, I feel we live in a society and world of just complete lawlessness. That Shock Doctrine book, really, I found it really affected me. I mean, she went from talking about the Cameron brainwashing Shock Doctrine methods, but then it goes into like the Chicago School of Economics and Milton Friedman and how they tried to deliver this kind of shock therapy to other countries. And they go through like Chile and Argentina and Brazil and Indonesia, all these countries that like the CIA and all these kind of intelligence communities help to usurp popular presidents and kind of establish their own regimes with dictators who would, cater to the international elites in terms of opening up their countries to foreign ownership and investment and control. And it's I read a book like that. I mean, this has been going on for years, I think you were a lot more informed of this through the last decades. I really had no idea of the horror that's kind of been perpetrated by the CIA in the United States around the world, and always based on lies, and media of lies and propaganda. And all the time, these things that we've done in a way, like Western civilization has done these, it's like there's no country on earth that's been allowed just to have a government responsible to the citizens. It's just shocking to me. It's very disheartening, I find, to see this kind of rampant criminality in our age. I would never have believed it.
Yeah, I have a completely different reaction to all that. It's like, so what? You know, I mean, this has been going on for... my reaction is more, you know, nobody ever wants to talk about these things. Nobody ever wants to recognize these things. And all the just the rhetoric about freedom and democracy is just complete BS, you know. It's like anybody who believes any of that crap is an idiot. That's my opinion, you know. It's like, well, I just don't understand what reality people are living in that they even can countenance those kinds of lies. And, you know, I'm always just I remember reading way back in the... At the beginning, when we were involved in getting involved in the Gurdjieff work and reading Uspensky's, I believe it's his New Model of the Universe, a collection of essays. In one of his essays, he talks a bit about history, and he talks about history is the history of crime, and he says we have terms for individual criminals and collections of criminals, but we have no terms for criminal states, and you know that really, if you look at history with an open mind, that's what you see, is that the history of crime. I think Gibbon, the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, said the same thing. But I'm reading a book right now. It's a very interesting book about the Cuban Missile Crisis and the difference in the reality between the difference between reality and the rhetoric from both the Soviet Union and the Americans prior to the Cuban Missile Crisis about their weapons and about Eisenhower. Kennedy campaigned on the idea of the missile gap, that the Russians had a superiority, and it was nothing even remotely close to a superiority. And the Russians kind of blustered and said that they could destroy the Americans because they had all these weapons. And they really actually didn't have that many weapons, but we get right down to it. But it was kind of one lie led to another lie, which led to another lie, which led to irrational behavior and escalation of the arms race. And you just see the whole thing as based on lies on both sides and just this kind of pathology. And then the other side of it, too, is that I've read some other books about the arms race in that period, especially Arsenals of Folly by Richard Rhodes, which is a really terrifying book because Rhodes' book is really very interesting. He wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book called The Making of the Atomic Bomb, which is a great book. I mean, a very interesting book because it deals with all aspects of the making of the atomic bomb, from the science of it to the politics of it. And then he wrote one on the hydrogen bomb. This book, Arsenals of Folly, he portrays both the Americans and the Russians, and anybody who thinks that the policies of those two countries are run by anybody who's even remotely rational, and the military, high up people in the military and the politicians, all complete lunatics, in my opinion. Like, after reading that book, it's like, that, even for me, that book really opened my eyes. It's just like, these people are all completely crazy. Like, not a bit crazy, completely crazy, on both sides, you know? And that's like, you know, when you consider the resources that were expended on the arms race, just think of that. You know, every country in the world could have clean water, drinking water, and could have medical facilities for their people just easily on the money that the Americans and the Russians spent during the Cold War on arms. I mean, the whole world spends all this money on arms, and, you know, you have millions and billions of people dying of starvation every year in the world. That could all easily be dealt with. There could be no world hunger problem in 20 years if people would stop spending money on arms, you know, and there actually might be more security. That's the ironic part. For, you know, the West is obsessed now with their security in light of the terrorist threat. Well, isn't that convenient? Because the terrorist threat succeeded the Soviet military threat. And once the Soviet military empire wasn't a threat, they needed something else to spend their money on. So, all of a sudden it was terrorism. Well, gee, that worked out well for everybody, didn't it? And really, you see that all these psychopaths, you know, who run things that everywhere, not just in the States, it's not just the Americans, it's not just the Russians, it's everywhere. Like, anywhere where there's power-possessing beings, in Gurdjieff's terms, you have psychopaths and sociopaths and other types of paths that are so demented they don't even have names for them. And so, you know, that's the way I kind of look at things. It's like, nothing surprises me. It just, I just, you know, I'm, it's just so hopeless in a way. Like, I mean, the things people will do for money, power, and sex, you know, it's really quite revolting.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. I'm one of those idiots that you describe, because, I mean, I wasn't politically oriented to my life, and, you know, was in the family way, and my other interest was pursuing mystical studies and such. So I think I was a lot less prepared for awakening to 9/11, which happened 5 years ago. And that set off, you know, over the past 5 years, like, I've spent most of my time on the internet radio, like, learning more and more about all this deviancy and history, and it's been like a completely new education for me. And so I was one of those idiots. I was one of those idiots who, in a way, kind of believed the corporate media and kind of believed in the government and such. I really had no idea of the extent of the criminality that has infiltrated and taken over our governments. It just shocks me. And it's funny, too, because I think at the same time, Bob Dylan had it all, he encapsulated it all so well back in the 60s with his song Masters of War. And in a way, it was all in that song. In a way, he just put it very simply, you know, these masters of war, you know, these people who build all the jet planes and the bombs and they sit behind their desks and they kind of inflict this suffering on humankind around the planet. And it's all based on lies and deviancy, and it's so tragic. Even as a clinical and forensic psychologist, having worked in prisons for 15 years, it's like these people have a level of psychopathy and deviancy. The people I dealt with were nothing compared to these guys. You know, at least with the people I dealt with, it was understandable kind of why they did the crimes they did. You know, they grow up in families with drug and alcohol abuse and sexual abuse and physical and broken families and all. And it was understandable how they get into the kinds of crimes they do. But these people, like... Well, I mean, I don't think anyone exposes them as well as Gurdjieff in his book, Beelzebub's Tales, where he has a special name for them, Hasnamasses, or Hasnamasses, which he defines as those who lack the divine impulse of conscience. That's how I see these people. Like, the people I know in my life, like, I can't imagine them being willing to murder people and things like that to amass money and power. Like, these people, like J. Edgar Hoover said, I keep going back to this quotation, he says, an individual is handicapped in coming face to face with a conspiracy so monstrous he cannot believe it exists. And that's what it is. It's like we've been told so many lies through the decades. And we just see the enormity of this tragedy that's been perpetrated around the world. And the wastage of human resources and life and time all on weapons. And now, you know, the surveillance state society and the police state society and more prisons and... it's truly tragic. It's like I think your reference to the fall of the Roman Empire is like, wow, we're going to witness the fall of the American Empire, or whatever you want to call this empire. I wouldn't really call it the American Empire, because it's really broader than that. It's not the American people. The American people are as much a victim of this all as other people in other countries, eh? Like,
yeah,
you look at those 50,000 Americans lost their lives in Vietnam, and then hundreds of thousands more come back permanently damaged or disabled. And, you know, now we have a country in the States, you know, I understand Las Vegas, they passed laws. You can't feed vets or house them. You know, we got these hundreds of thousands of vets that are homeless, and it's like the governments, you know, they talk, you support your soldiers and such, but it's all just BS. It's all just more lies. Yeah. So, well, I'm not sure if I. Yeah, it's shocking to me. I'm upset over the loss of Karen, and yet I think, wow, like she, in a way, was so lucky, you know, got to live to be 55. And I look, you know, what's going on in these countries in the Middle East, and I can't imagine the kind of horror and suffering that these people have been through all these wars and occupation of their countries. And it's always the regular people who are victims of these wars. So I've been reading The Shock Doctrine. That was the first thing I wanted to mention. And the book's been quite a shock to me. I had to put it aside because I had to start reading another book for my article that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes.
Oh, yeah. Are you getting that echo?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay, good. I'm echoing a bit, so, okay.
Am I echoing to you? Or
you're fine. I can hear you.
Oh,
fine.
Yeah.
It's just there's a little bit of a trailer when I speak. I hear myself coming back a little bit. So.
Oh, yeah, I think Don in the studio may have been needing to amplify your sound. He was saying your phone wasn't as loud as mine. Okay, so anyway, I didn't mean to get into the political side today, but I wanted to just share some of the things I've been reading, and that was the first one that's had kind of an impact on me. And I'm trying to, I've had a three-part article series submitted to the Journal of Esoteric Studies, an online referee journal, and I've had three articles accepted in the series I've been doing, entitled On the Origins and Nature of Human Consciousness. And I've come to part four of that, and part four is to be a concluding section of that article. And I wanted to talk about that today, what I'm coming to. But as I was been working at that article, I started reading another book because it was on, like, information theory and physics. It's called The Bit and the Pendulum, which is a very clever title, eh? The Bit and the Pendulum, based on the pit and the pendulum, except it's the bit, referring to, like, computer bytes. I found such a good quote in this book by John Archibald Wheeler, who's probably the most famous physicist almost of the last 50 years, one of the most famous in the world. And you and I have been talking about how in the Gurdjieff teaching and esotericism, we have a basic like law of three, whereby all things are regarded as having a material, an energetic, and an information aspect, and how information is regarded as third force in modern physics, in quantum information theory and the new model of holography in physics. And I came across this quote from John Wheeler. And he says, I think of my lifetime in physics as divided into three periods. In the first period, I was in the grip of the idea that everything is particles. I call my second period, everything is fields. Now I'm in the grip of a new vision that everything is information. I thought that was a really interesting quote, John Wheeler.
So we went from matter to energy to information.
Yeah.
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 And he says it from bit, right? That's his...
Yeah, that's his quote, it.
Yeah.
Meaning material process, material phenomena come from bit, meaning bits of information. So in the new physics, it's like they see information is more primary than material energetic organization. So it comes from bit.
Yeah, it's interesting too, just to sort of to interject here, but when his progress is interesting because he's going from kind of matter, which is like structure and substance, and then to fields, which is sort of quasi materialistic, right? Fields are really interesting because, I mean, they're recognized as material concepts in physics. That is, Theodore Rozek says it's like fields are almost as spectral themselves as the Holy Ghost in a way. Like, you know, fields are very mysterious in a way. But then, like, what Bohm points out is that when you get to Bit, it's like Bohm points out that even like fields are local. You know, they're contiguous, and so, like, fields don't really capture the non-local nature of reality. So it's an extrapolation, and even further from a materialist perspective, when you start talking about non-locality, because fields themselves, it's a local concept, eh? Like, it's not a non-local concept.
Bohm points out about Einstein. He says, even though Einstein came up with the idea of fields, he still had like a local concept of fields. I think another, you could substitute in Wheeler's explanation, like his second period related to fields might be related to energy.
How
people were regarding everything as energy, and then fields have different quanta which convey the energy of that field. But it is interesting because what we see in esotericism is that, and I'm thinking particularly of The Secret Doctrine of Blavatsky, which is a very authoritative book of esoteric studies. One sees in terms of creation physics that when creation occurs, the firstborn are like the seven divine sons. Or she calls them the builders of Manvantaric Dawn, like the builders, which are seven divine intelligences. She also calls them the workmen, architects. And then what they do, the seven divine intelligences, so it's their intelligence which it then brings about the creation of energies and matters on different planes of being. But in a way, matter and energy derive ultimately from these, first there's the divine intelligences, and then there's seven luminous suns connected, like seven spiritual intelligences, like the same pattern, but in the spiritual realm. So both the divine and spiritual intelligences, is like their intelligences form the information that allows for the organization of matter and energy. So you see in esotericism, it is information that comes first. And that's why this is a really interesting development in modern physics. Of course, when they talk about information in modern physics, I've not heard anyone think that this information is an embodiment of spiritual or divine intelligences. Like, they don't go that far. They have the concept of information, but not of this as being information, a product of conscious intelligences. So that's very different from, like, Blavatsky's perspective compared with science.
Yeah, and that's... That raises a whole series of interesting questions about, you know, what's next in terms of physics, you know, because physics doesn't really deal with spirituality, but by the same token, it's interesting how, even in Wheeler's description, how you get farther and farther away from this idea of the world as being a material realm to an energetic realm, to an information realm, but beyond the there's something beyond the information realm in the mystical and esoteric teachings, and it's entirely consistently. It's interesting because spiritual esotericism would have predicted this progression in terms of understanding things in physics, right? Like, I mean, it's entirely consistent with the perspective that's presented within an esoteric perspective. But
yeah, that's a really good point. That's exactly so. It's like what you would expect. It would, like, that from an esoteric perspective, you'd think that materially oriented scientists, they would begin with matter because that's most visual and evident, and then come to energy, like understanding the energetic principles that organize matter, and then come to information. So, as you say, that's really interesting. You would have expected that threefold progression in terms of the evolution of modern knowledge.
And then it's what gets interesting is that you could intellectually accept or hypothesize the existence of spiritual domains and intelligences, and suggest that you could do what's actually done, like in Blavatsky's work and other esoteric works, where you could actually explain things in an intellectual, rational mode about and model things in terms of providing explanations of these spiritual intelligences behind the information, but really, to know these things, you have to use another part of the mind other than just our normal waking consciousness, and that's kind of the breaking point in a way between science as it's constituted now and the esoteric sciences, and like the esoteric sciences are premised on the idea that we can develop other faculties and aspects of our intelligence and consciousness, in which we can realize things that we can't know with our normal waking consciousness, even when we're using the most developed aspects of our intellects. We can only go so far because there are certain limitations imposed by our level of consciousness. So we have to attain a different level of consciousness and being to actually apprehend these other realities and to understand and interpret them. It's very interesting how, to me, it is that, like, you have this debate within some people who even are sympathetic to esotericism as to what is the impact, or like what integration can we realize between spiritual teachings and modern science? And some people say, well, you know, you can only go so far, but you know, it's dangerous because you don't want to tie mystical and spiritual insights down to existent scientific thinking, because it's going to change on different things, and then where does that leave you? But I sort of see it that's an objection that several people raise, but I think the other side of it is that the mystical and spiritual teachings, which are based on these different levels of consciousness and being and different realizations and apprehensions from those levels of consciousness and being, I think inform science and point the way to certain things that science, I think, might in its own way come to realize or might come to accept. And so I think really the flow of information is more, it's not so much that we need science to corroborate these spiritual visions. I don't think we need it at all, but I think that science shouldn't be inconsistent with these things, and I don't think that it is. I think that's what's so interesting, is that as science progresses, I think it more and more allows for an application of a mystical and esoteric perspective, which is precisely what you've been doing in your work. The big thing is that science doesn't recognize the extremely profound nature and mystery of consciousness. Consciousness is the key to understanding all of these things and to providing that extra dimensions of perspective, which allows one to see things in their proper place and to integrate them. At least that's the way I see it. I think that spiritual and mystical esotericism has an important part to play in terms of informing science, but I don't think we have to tie ourselves to science in the sense that, you know, if science changes, then it somehow invalidates these insights.
Yeah, I remember Wilbur making that comment, I think, back in his book on the holographic paradigm. I agree that we can't simply equate them, but we do want to look for parallels and draw out the complexity of it, because certainly esotericism, in my view, leads to very definite predictions about what should be the structure of reality, if they're true. For instance, like, there's no doubt in the secret doctrine, Madame Blavatsky is postulating what in modern times would be called seven-dimensional hyperspace. Now, she doesn't use the word hyperspace. She uses the word eternal parent space. Okay, but she says it is seven-skinned. And in all the creation physics of the secret doctrine, everything is sevenfold. Like there are seven luminous suns, seven divine beings, and then there are seven full hearts, and there are seven levels to the ether, like the divine mother. So this pattern of sevenfoldness is definitely would be a prediction of the based on the secret doctrine. And the stanzas even at one point say seven inside, seven outside. And this is describing how material worlds are created out of the hyperspace. So hyperspace is seven-dimensional. So then when creation happens, there are said to be seven planes of existence, seven inside, seven outside. So there are certain, like, I think that esotericism, a book like Blavatsky's, leads to very definite predictions. Like another prediction, I would say, is inherent to the secret doctrine. Blavatsky begins by her secret doctrine explanation. She begins with the image of a circle with a point in its center. And she says this symbol represents the first point of differentiation of a cosmos. And in a way, if you had taken that concept from Blavatsky back in 1888, if you had thought it out, you would have predicted, in a way, the singularity origin of our universe, which was a concept that came about in modern science, came to be accepted 100 years after Blavatsky, back in the 1980s, I think, they began tracing the universe back to a singularity. So, but in a way, that concept was already inherent in what Blavatsky had said in 1888. So I think, too much people think, oh, mystical and spiritual teachings, they're apart from science, and you can't investigate them scientifically, or there's no scientific merit to it. To such ideas, it's only a matter of faith or belief. And I think that's the fundamental misconception, because I think in a way these teachings are quite specific in many regards and actually propose very serious scientific hypotheses, like, for instance, the seven-dimensional nature of hyperspace. Or another example in mysticism, I argue that they all point towards the emergence of human consciousness out of the heart instead of being a byproduct of the material brain in the head. So there you have very specific scientific hypotheses which can be derived from a mystical perspective. And you can investigate those hypotheses scientifically. And you can invalidate them. I mean, if scientists had been able to prove what part of the brain produced consciousness, I think you could have invalidated these mystical teachings. But instead, what's happened is the issues of consciousness have remained the number one enigma in modern science. And most scientists have no idea what the mystics even suggest about these issues, which is a shame, because they're so limited in their conceptualizations of what consciousness could be, that if you study the esoteric tradition, it kind of broadens your outlook, at least to consider other hypotheses.
I think there's several examples of that, and I think that's when skeptics and naysayers, denouncers of mysticism and esotericism say that, you know, that mysticism doesn't make any predictions. Religions don't have any verifiable predictions. It's like, it's that the people who are saying this don't really know anything about the esoteric and mystical traditions and haven't really studied them, so they don't recognize how profound they are and how they make lots of predictions and actually provide a very coherent perspective on both a psychological and a cosmological level, which leads to an entirely different framework in understanding things and does lead to all sorts of predictions. I was making notes in from my book and I just generated this list off the top of my head, but here's what I said. Within the mystical and esoteric literature, we find, one, claims that our normal waking consciousness is not a proper consciousness, and as such leads to illusory knowledge and understanding of oneself and the world. Two, repeated assertions that consciousness is something separate from the psychic functions. Three, the equation of consciousness with light and light, like light small l and light big L, which is like electromagnetic spectrum light, and then like a more supernal or higher dimensional light. Four, elaborations of this idea which involve metaphorical, alchemical, and metaphysical meanings of consciousness as light. So consciousness as light is a metaphor, but it's also meant alchemically and it's also meant metaphysically, and it applies both psychologically and cosmologically. Five, formulations of higher states of consciousness than the normal waking state, which may be realized through systematic self-study and discipline. Six, referrals to the existence of the subtle anatomy and descriptions of the higher being bodies as the means by which higher world orders may be apprehended. Seven, cosmological schemes in which there exists a hierarchy of world orders or discrete orders of consciousness and materiality which descend from the absolute, a unity which exists beyond all conceptualization, and which involves a nesting of each level within that above it. Eight, the description of both an involutionary and an evolutionary process within creation. Nine, the consistent description of the triune nature of reality in which all of creation is the manifestation of the interaction of three fundamental forces. 10, the repeated references to seven levels of creation and the significance of the septenary nature of creation. 11, the repeated references to the idea that consciousness emerges from within the subtle dimensions of the heart and illuminates the mind. 12, the repeated descriptions of consciousness existing apart from the physical body. 13, the repeated references to the origins of the universe from a point source. 14, the repeated reference to the holographic nature of the self and the universe, wherein the whole exists within each of the parts, and the possibility to know oneself, the universe, and the gods exists. 15, the repeated references to a vacated space as being necessary for both creation and the generation of consciousness on a human level. 16, the repeated description of the cosmos as being animate, intelligent, and maintained and informed by an omniscient intelligence. 17, the repeated descriptions and accounts of the folly and illusion inherent in the materialistic perspective on and interpretation of reality. 18, repeated descriptions of masters and gurus who, having attained higher states of consciousness, have acquired paranormal powers and in whose presence there is an experience of the transfer of spiritual energies and intelligence. That's just a list I just made up.
Wow, that's a really good list.
Yeah, it is.
That's a striking list.
I mean, and there's so much in each of those propositions, eh? Like, I mean, and as I say, that's just what I extrapolate. I didn't even think about it very long. That actually came out of one of our earlier programs when we were talking, and I just started sort of writing them down, and I just thought, wow, you know, when you really start thinking about it, it just shows how absurd, like, for instance, somebody like Carl Sagan, in the varieties of scientific experiences, which is his Gifford lectures on religion and science. And he essentially says that, you know, that the problem with religion is it doesn't make any predictions that can be verified scientifically. Well, everything on that, in those 18 items, it all pertains to science and to the study of ourselves and the universe. And everyone leads to predictions which can be either verified or dismissed.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, that's a really good list. That's neat that you've done that. I'd like to get you to send me that, and I'll try to consider and maybe add to that.
Oh, I definitely would be interested, in your feedback on it and to try to develop it a little bit. But it's almost, as I say, it's just so striking when the more you know about these things after all these years, as we found out and we're studying them, the more you realize the applicability of all these different ideas is so profound, and the more depth you gain in terms of understanding, the more coherent they become, and you can apply them on different levels. You can apply these things on the psychological and on the cosmological level, and it's entirely coherent. There's nothing about this that's in any way misty, insubstantial, imaginary, or fanciful. It's precisely the opposite, right? That's what's so amazing, is that people don't have a clue what they're talking about when they dismiss esotericism and mysticism.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think that's what we have attempted to do ourselves over the last 40 years, actually, is, I mean, we've been able to discern these essential teachings in varied esoteric traditions so that we're able to bring them out and make a list like you just produced. Yeah, I mean, see, people don't have the translators that go from reading something like the Secret Doctrine to what it all means. Like, people don't have the link, things that make these esoteric books accessible to us. And I think that's what we've attempted to do through our life work. Because we're both, like, I always like the fourth way, because what Gurdjieff said, like, the fourth way, he says, believe nothing. Like, he says, this is not a way of belief, which most people kind of think of religions are a way of belief. You kind of, this is God's word, and you're supposed to believe it word for word, and then you believe it. And, you know, if you're a true Christian, you believe, you know, it's a word of God. Mr. God himself wrote it down, you know. In a way, what we've done over the past 40 years, it's not easy to go into the mystical literature and come up with such a succinct summary of points as you've just produced. Like that, like, most people never get to that level of, in terms of understanding religions. Instead, people see the obvious differences between religions because of language and cultural groups and things like that, and they never discern the esoteric side of religions, where we find the same themes common to the different religions. So people are never exposed really to that aspect of religious or mystical or spiritual teachings. And that's kind of what our life work has largely been about, focusing on the issues of consciousness. But then we, you know, I became interested in creation physics, and I think you've long been more interested in the enigmas of biology and evolution and such. And it's like, once you know esoteric perspective, you can apply the perspective to any area of science. And it gives you a whole alternative perspective on the issues of that area of science. Like, I've done that with physics and cosmology, primary. We've both done it with the consciousness studies. But there's really no aspect of scholarship or science or philosophy where you can't apply a mystical perspective. And it gives you a whole alternative kind of paradigm and understanding. It's an amazing area of study, and it's like you say, it's not the mystical teachings are unintelligible. They're only unintelligible when someone first encounters them and begins to study them. The more and more you learn, it reveals more and more truths that you then see confirmed in different literatures. Similar concepts.
And I think, again, it's sort of going back to the Wheeler quote, I think it's kind of like also like there's elements and dimensions to the mystical and esoteric teachings, which I think are higher in the sense that they're more subtle and they're more comprehensive and they're more primary. I'm trying to think of an analogy in terms of, it's kind of like, you know, going from Newtonian mechanics to relativity theory to quantum mechanics. Is like there's an intellectual progression to it that's very difficult to, well, it's unimaginable until you've actually been confronted with it. And then when you begin to acquire the fundamentals and begin to understand this different perspective, what you see very clearly is you see the relativity of knowledge. That's one thing. And you also, I think the main thing is that you just see, it's just the assumptive framework that underlies most conventional thinking in most areas of knowledge. You can see through it in a sense, and you see that, oh, yeah, that these ideas and these interpretations exist, and they make sense on a certain level, but they only make sense because of certain fundamental assumptions. And what mysticism and esotericism does is to challenge the assumptive framework, which the epistemological framework, which underlies most conventional knowledge, and reveals that it's somehow fundamentally incorrect. And I think that's a great advantage. And the more you work at it, the more you see how off everything is in a way in our conventional current knowledge of things. And then you see also too that a very interesting thing is that when you have this different perspective, and we've experienced this with specifically with respect to consciousness. Again, to me, it's kind of like I just listen to most people when they're talking about consciousness and their brains, and I just kind of roll my eyes because people say things all the time that you realize that there. I feel like saying to them, "You realize there's absolutely no scientific evidence for that, don't you? That you know, my brain does this, my brain does that." It's like, no, you know that there's no evidence for that. That's just an assumption. It's a convention. It's one that's widely assumed and is widely regarded as being correct, but that doesn't mean it is correct. And there's an entirely different way of thinking about this, but of course it's too complex to get into, so you just sort of, like I hear all the time, this drives me completely up the wall, I hear all the time that people say this, and they say it in a way that it's like there's no question about it, like that we're hardwired for this and we're hardwired for that. And like that's an analogy to like us being computers, but you know, we're not hardwired, you know. I mean, as I said in the last program, we compute, and you know, there are various computing aspects to a human being, like information is processed, but we're not computers. I mean, it's completely bizarre to even suggest that, and we are not hardwired. I guess the question is, if we are, who's doing the wiring?
that
presumes there's a wirer somewhere who's doing this. Like, and it just is so silly. Like, it's just completely ridiculous. And it's the same thing with as we spoke on the last program as well. That part of my brain doesn't work, and it's like you realize again that you know there's some. There is some scientific evidence underlying this, but your interpretation is so grossly, you know, out of whack with what's actually been established that it's meaningless, you know, and that's the whole left brain, right brain schema is completely, you know, ridiculous in terms of the way it's used by most people and to explain things.
It was interesting this week. I have also been reading another book, which brings up this kind of issue in another part, department of science, and it's a book by Michael Cremo, and it's called The Devolution of Man.
Oh.
Are you familiar with
Michael
Cremo?
I don't know that book, no.
It's a great big fat book. Like it's like 700 pages long. It's huge. But he's a real scholar. And it's actually dedicated the book to Swami Prabhupada.
Oh.
And partly what he's doing in the book, he's saying that the ancient Vedas of India claim that there were these very advanced races way earlier in human history than conceived in modern thought, millions of years ago. And he hasn't got a lot into that. But then he explains that how the current view of man evolving through random mutations and chance evolutionary processes, they believe man originated about 200,000 years ago. And then in his book, he documents this extensively, showing all kinds of human artifacts as well as other fossil remains. Oh, excuse me for that. He discovered in sediment from half million, even millions of years ago, and all these anomalies suggesting that there's evidence for human-like creatures even millions of years ago, and all these kinds of findings which have been suppressed, and he points out like it's just. you read this book, and it's like kind of overwhelming evidence, I would consider it to be, that the idea that we evolved through this kind of random process over the past 200,000 years is really just quite farcical. Like, it's not evident in the fossil record, and there's all kinds of anomalies, and there's some artifacts which suggest advanced creatures like even millions of years ago. It's a fascinating book, and his main thesis, which I haven't come to yet, but what he does is he differentiates three levels: the spirit, the mind, and the body. And his whole argument, which he's not come to yet in the book, is that instead of man evolving up from matter through these kind of Darwinian processes, really it's a devolution, or what Gurdjieff would call an involutionary process. And he's arguing that what's essential in the human being forms in the spirit world first, then the mind world, then the is incarnated into the body. So it's the devolution of man instead of the evolution of man. It's a fascinating book, and I'll report on it more over time as I get through it.
Do you know who published that book? Is that published by the International Society for Krishna Consciousness?
No, it's not. It's I don't have it handy at the moment.
Yeah.
But he has a prior book too called Forbidden Archaeology.
Oh yeah, I have that book. I was
it's another massive one. He says it's full of evidences too. Again, showing all these enigmas. Like, there's so many enigmas. Even things like the pyramids, like how were the pyramids really built? And we're always kind of told, well, you just take enough slaves and, that they can lift these giant blocks up, and, there's so many things that have never been explained. The 25-ton Easter Island heads. Like, there's so many things in human history. These vast submerged artifacts that they found off the underwater, like that Hancock's book on,
right,
underwater archaeology, which I want to get to read that as well.
2,000-year-old battery, isn't there? It's like a battery or something that's that. Yeah, there's. Well, it's funny because I think on the back of that Forbidden Archaeology, I think Richard Leakey says that this book is complete nonsense, but it's like, there's always like, these controversies. There's a joke by Stephen Wright, the comedian, that about the pyramids, where he says that archaeologists have been trying to figure out for years who built the pyramids, and they're pretty sure it was a guy named Eddie. And always, that always struck me as, like, in Gurdjieff's work, he said at one point, he's talking about the Sphinx, and he says that the Sphinx was actually a copy of a much more ancient statue symbol that had existed thousands of years before. He talks about pre-Sand Egypt, right? About that the history of Egypt was much, much, much more ancient than was recognized by modern archaeology and historians.
Yeah, that was interesting. My Slugs book, I have reference to Ottawa Citizen article where they report that archaeologists claim to have found this whole underwater city completely submerged, like 5 to 10 miles north of Egypt, and this, like, under the water, earlier Egyptian society, and it kind of fell in perfectly with what Gurdjieff was saying, that there's like a more ancient Egypt that we don't know of. And also in Beelzebub's tales, Beelzebub explains that after the submergence of Atlantis, that certain groups of initiates in Atlantis, and he mentions the Akkadian society, they were aware of this imminent catastrophe, and so they had seeded the new world and gone out into the new world in order to kind of preserve their ancient knowledge. and he describes them as taking part in the construction of the pyramids in Egypt, because that's kind of recounted in one of Beelzebub's, in his fifth visit to the earth. It's kind of at the time where the pyramids are being built. I think in modern education and science, it's like in different departments of knowledge, there have been these dogmas which have become the orthodoxy, and then you see scientists kind of losing their bobtailed reason altogether, and kind of maintaining their orthodoxies and as matter-of-factly dismissing new evidences. That's kind of the basic point. So all the evidences of man's ancient history have been suppressed because they don't fit what is the kind of standard model. And you see it in different disciplines, I think. You see it in psychology. It's like how there's been this almost complete suppression within academic psychology of investigations of the paranormal and the psychical and the spiritual. Like these, instead what we got were certain dogmas which became the accepted orthodoxy of the day, and these other viewpoints and perspectives have been suppressed. And I think we can kind of see that in different departments of knowledge. Like in terms of evolutionary theory and history, the history of the human race on this planet, there's so many anomalies that are unexplained. The possible influence of aliens and the interbreeding of aliens with human beings on this planet, those kinds of possibilities. There's so many unknowns. It's funny. I look back when I completed my university education, and what I was exposed to, the three main influences I would say were Marxism, Darwinianism, and existentialism. Those are kind of the three main influences that I was exposed to. And for you and I, we both made kind of a right turn at some point in our careers when we stepped into the study of the mystical. And then it's through over 40 years, it kind of just brings you to question more and more. It's like as I learned more and more, I knew less and less.
Well, yeah, and that's... Anyways. I think that's a huge part on a variety of levels, on the intellectual, but also just on the practical level. It's the importance of knowing what you know and what you don't know is, and that's the beginning of the true spiritual, I think, journey through esotericism and mysticism, is that you have to realize you have to unlearn a lot of things. You have to suspend your judgment. I think that's the best way of saying it. Is that was the overwhelming impression I got from first reading Gurdjieff. It's like I was like you. I really liked the fact that he said, "Look, you know, I'm not asking or telling you to believe any of this. In fact, I don't believe it. You know, you have to verify this for yourself, because this isn't a path of faith. That it's not dogma. It's something. This is a path of understanding, and you have to understand these things. And you can understand it by studying it in yourselves and other people, and you can understand it by studying it on a cosmological level. And some things will inform your psychological understanding, and vice versa. And so treat these as like it's very scientific in the sense that treat these ideas as hypotheses, and realize that. The most important thing you can do is that you have to study yourself systematically. You can't just sort of observe yourself willy-nilly without any kind of system to organize things. You have to study it, and I'm suggesting studying it in this system, and you'll see things. And I think that very quickly both you and I realize it's like, boy, this is just like so different, and it requires you to suspend your judgment about things. Like there are many things in Gurdjieff that I studied at the beginning that I don't have any clue what he's talking about. You know, what does this mean? Like, I didn't grasp what he meant by the fundamental cosmic laws, a law of three and a law of seven, but I knew that I didn't know that. That wasn't, I couldn't just say, oh, well, that's just, you know, and then dismiss it or categorize it or somehow neutralize it. I realized I don't know. I don't know. So I'll just leave it and I'll come back to it. As I gain more knowledge, I'll try to understand it better. And that's the approach you have to take. It's like that great Zen story about the Western teacher who goes to the Zen master and asks him to teach him Zen, and he, the master, replies by serving tea, and then he starts to fill the visitor's cup up with tea, and he keeps pouring, and it overflows, and it overflows, and it overflows, and finally the visitor says, "Stop, stop, it's overflowing." And he said, "How can I teach you Zen if you don't empty your own cup, but the cup of your mind? You're so full of your own ideas and opinions about everything. I can't teach you Zen until you empty your cup." You know, and that's, I think that's exactly right. That's the part that when people try to criticize mysticism or esotericism from a materialist perspective, they're so full of them, their own ideas and beliefs about how things are, that they don't acknowledge, they don't have the humility to realize that first they haven't really studied these things in any meaningful way. They've just sort of read them and said, "Oh, that's nonsense," and so they're automatically dismissive of them. Yeah, but they're so full of themselves that they haven't stopped to suspend their own judgment and approach them with an open mind and impartially. And that's the test that you have to meet if you're going to understand these things. And then you have to be prepared to put a lot of work into trying to figure them out, because they're not easy ideas to comprehend.
Yeah, I can't think of a better example than understanding the fundamental cosmic laws. Because I remember reading that in Gurdjieff. Like, he's saying, oh, the law of three and the law of seven. In the way I thought at the time, like, okay, like, it's a bit ridiculous. Like, how can you have a law in the number, kind of?
Yeah.
I see now how you can, of course, because what he's talking about is principles of creation or principles underlying manifestation. Like, so the law of three and the law of seven, these are like, when God, if God designs the universe, when he designed the universe, he uses certain principles. So the law of three and seven refer to the concept that he uses the law of three and the law of seven to create the universes. And it's all analogous to white light being divided by a three-sided prism, and it gives you a spectrum of seven colors. So it's so when reading that initially, it like seemed so arbitrary, it seemed so arbitrary. But it was like other things Gurdjieff was saying about psychology were so obviously valuable to me as an academic psychologist at the time. So I could see, for instance, how his description of man as functioning in a triune way, mentally, emotionally, and physically, and I could see how psychology was all dualistic, the science of behavior and the mind, the brain and the body. Like, psychology was always dualistic. So I could see examples in Gurdjieff's teaching that showed, in a way, the limitations all the time of modern psychology, and it was so applicable, like the things he said about consciousness, where he says you have to distinguish between consciousness and psychic functions. And at the same time, I was reading all the consciousness literature and realizing everybody is equating those, doing exactly what Gurdjieff says you shouldn't do. So because it was because of the kind of realizing the profound insights in his psychology that kind of led me to suspend judgment on other aspects of his system, like the fundamental cosmic laws. And then I think the other important concept that is very important is what Gurdjieff calls the ray of creation, which in the Gurdjieff teaching, it's like the cosmic octave, and the top do is the absolute, and then that absolute manifests the universe or a creation process that goes through seven periods or creates seven planes of existence. So you have the absolute as the top do, and then you have seven notes below it, and that's called the ray of creation. And then Gurdjieff, in this ray of creation, that the first level he calls all worlds, and that kind of refers to, like, we live in the universe, and surrounding us are all these different galaxies and quasars. And so firstly, we live in all worlds. And then within all worlds, we live within one galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. So within all worlds, we then live within the Milky Way galaxy. That's our home galaxy. And then within that galaxy, we live within a particular solar system. And that solar system has then particular planets. And then we come to the Earth, and then below the Earth is the Moon. So Gurdjieff has this ray of creation, begins with the absolute, all worlds, the galaxy, the solar system, the planets, the Earth, the Moon, and then below that he says the absolute nothing at the bottom of the ray of creation. And then he has a concept. He says that levels of a human being correspond to these different levels of the structure of the ray of creation. So he says there's a level in the human being that corresponds to the level of the sun, and another level that corresponds to the level of the planets and the earth and the moon, and to the level of what he calls the starry world. So I think this was a concept from Gurdjieff early on that really took a long time to seriously consider, that somehow there's something in us that is connected to these different levels of the larger ray of creation. And it's very interesting, like, we can see upon death, I can see how the material body goes back and it feeds the earth. Okay, and then at death, Gurdjieff says that certain soul energies or vital energies, they feed the moon, Gurdjieff says. And there's evidence that at times Gurdjieff thinks or suggests that souls can pass to the moon and actually be held in servitude on the moon, where there's a kind of a greater number of laws, under what he calls 96 laws at the level of the moon. Or Gurdjieff suggests you can pass if you solidify your astral body, then you can survive, and you survive living off the atmospheres, because the airs, different substances in airs, are what maintain the astral body. So in your astral body, you can survive in the atmospheres, or even be connected to the planets and the sun. And then your spiritual body, he connects to the sun. And then the divine level, or what he calls the fourth room that a person might attain, is related to the level of the starry worlds. And Gurdjieff says, if a man attains to this fourth room and attains to this level, he becomes immortal within the limits of the solar system. Okay, so I remember early on, like, that's just to give our listeners, Jim, just some idea of what Gurdjieff says about the connection of the inner being to levels of the universal structure or the solar system structure. And I remember at the time, like, back 40 years ago when we started studying the Gurdjieff teaching, although those ideas were very interesting, that was another area which had to be suspended for like 20 to 30 years for me to really begin to understand those things more seriously as concepts, such that now I in a way I can understand how we could be connected to these different levels of the cosmos and have different, what Gurdjieff calls, higher being bodies that can enable us to live within these subtle planes of existence. But if I go back 40 years ago, like, that was just so far ahead of us at the time. So I think it was really useful. I think, in a way, both of us had a very scientific attitude towards our studies of not simply accepting things, but trying to discern them and understand them over time. And that, you know, to arrive at understanding, you can't be given understanding. You know, you can acquire knowledge and learn knowledge, but unless it's balanced by some development in your being or in your experience, then it can simply be empty knowledge in your mind, and then it's of no use to you. But I think from very early on, we both suspended judgment, and then over time, you know, we considered really more and more bizarre ideas in our studies that we would never have imagined initially 40 years ago.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, from the Gurdjieff perspective, is that those ideas led to examining other teachings and other systems and other material to try to substantiate and try to develop a deeper understanding of what these concepts refer to. For instance, in the Gurdjieff teaching, there isn't a great deal of emphasis or explication of the subtle bodies and of the subtle worlds. They're definitely referred to, they're definitely important, but there's not an emphasis on them. So I know that in your case, that led you more to explore, that's, I think, how you originally got into theosophy, was through maybe Powell and Ledbetter and a few people writing about the astral body and the subtle anatomy, and you were kind of interested in that, and then you got interested more and more in the ideas about the soul and started to study Prabhupada's work, and then Prabhupada's work led you to the Bhagavad Gita, and you started studying the Gita, and then that led you in turn to other things. You know, and it's interesting how different ideas, you know, are like seeds, and the more you cultivate them and nourish them, the more that they become something quite different, quite unimaginable, and then they become more complex and they become fundamentally different. And then the great thing about esotericism is that each idea sort of reinforces and reflects the other ideas, and because they're integrated somehow holographically, and they're very, not to go too new age, but it's like an organic whole. But it really is like that. It's like there's a comprehensiveness and a coherence to things. That's what I always think are the most distinguishing features of esoteric teachings, is that they're comprehensive and they're coherent, and that the one doesn't develop at the expense of the other. My experience in terms of intellectual ideas, and like you said, you know, we're exposed to Marxism and existentialism and Darwinianism and psychoanalysis and a variety of other teachings, my reaction is that if you explored things, that the more coherent, the more comprehensive became, the less coherent they became, and the more coherent things became, the less comprehensive they became. And that's what I see in esotericism that really distinguishes it from all other thought, is that I think it's somehow integrated in such a unique way that the more comprehensive it becomes, the whole becomes, the more coherent the parts become, and vice versa. It's like, it's really quite extraordinary. And then getting back to what we talked about at the beginning of the very program, is that as you say, the law of 3 and 7 is like the example of something that you don't know, and it's really quite extraordinary. And like, gee, you know, how could I possibly ever understand that? And then you begin to grasp it on certain levels. But the other thing, too, is that Gurdjieff's fundamental assertion that our normal waking consciousness should be understood to be a waking sleep, that's what first convinced me that there was much to what he was saying, because I began to study myself and to try to understand myself, my consciousness, and I saw that what he was saying was correct, was that my normal waking consciousness consisted of a waking sleep, that I didn't really exist in the sense of being present and being conscious and aware, that everything happened to me and that I couldn't do, as he says, people can't do because they don't possess a unified I and they don't possess will. And that's exactly what I saw. And then the more he said, you know, that the whole world is like this. It's everybody's asleep. And for me, that's what made sense to me. Like you talked earlier about the horror of things and how you can't understand it. It's like, that's exactly what I saw. It's like, oh, what other explanation for the way that the world is could there be other than the fact that everybody's asleep? That's how I saw it anyway. It's like, that just makes perfect sense. I saw it on an individual level, but then I saw it on a societal level and on an interpersonal level and a cultural level. It's like, yeah, all of these sleepwalkers all bumping around into one another, and nobody's really doing anything. Everything really happens, you know, just as he says, everything happens. And I remember it's just kind of like coming out of like a tale of a fairy tale. It's like coming out of this dream and you know, sort of sticking my head into this other dimension and my existing in this other dimension where I could see things that I couldn't see normally because I was just a sleepwalker. And that's, yeah, I think that was truly astounding to me, is that earned Gurdjieff all sorts of idiosyncrasy credits with me. Is like, okay, if he's right about this, I'm willing to suspend my judgment about all these other crazy things he says, you know, and to realize that I don't know.
Yeah, because you begin to realize that, oh, if I could attain to this a higher level of consciousness, then what things I might understand or realize in such higher states.
Yeah.
Because you begin to see how what he says is so true, how we have no real I, how we're controlled and conditioned by 100 internal and external stimuli, and we have this kind of false consciousness system. So we could see that in ourselves very early on. Everything in his psychology was so profound. For people who've never studied themselves with the Gurdjieff psychology, I really encourage that. I still don't think there's anything as practical as a teaching for a person who wants to attain, firstly, practical self-knowledge. Because in a way, when they say we need to acquire self-knowledge, I think that begins with acquiring a knowledge of the way we are now. Like when we began to see how asleep we were and how we couldn't remember to be aware of ourselves and how all these things went on in us automatically and how everybody else was the same. You begin to see how asleep and conditioned everybody is, including yourself.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of losing my point a little bit of what that's... So you realize also, yeah, so if there were further possibilities of other conscious states, and then Gurdjieff says that, like, ideas like the laws of 3 and 7 and the formula like man is a microcosm of the macrocosm, or as above, so below, all of these he calls objective formula or symbols which embody objective understanding. So we can't understand them in our normal state of consciousness. We have to acquire something in ourself, develop something in ourself to understand these principles in a deeper way. Because understanding the law of 3 is not simply a matter of remembering it in your mind and being able to give different examples. It can begin with that, but it grows much deeper and deeper over time. And understanding, I also valued that so much, understand the laws of 3 and 7 in Gurdjieff, because then it provided a key for me, I felt, to understand other esoteric teachings, like understanding Kabbalah, when you have the laws of 3 and 7, and it's throughout in the Tree of Life and the Ladder of Jacob and the Star of David. Like, the laws of 3 and 7 are totally inherent to Kabbalah. And then they're inherent to the secret doctrine. And then they're in the Vedas. You know, so it's because I think we gained that background of understanding in the Gurdjieff teaching, I think it opened us up to understanding, it provided the keys to unlocking the meaning in other esoteric teachings that we might not otherwise have had. Like, I remember reading that quote by Rumi. He says, inside this jar are seven oceans and innumerable stars, which is a beautiful quote. And it's the jar, he's meaning like the universe, and in that he's saying there are seven oceans. And you see, in a way, that's what Blavatsky's saying. There's a seven-skinned eternal parent space. And then he says, there are seven oceans and innumerable stars. And the stars, the mystical concept is that each person has a spark of the divine, prime source emanation within them. And that's our ultimate kind of star nature. But in a way, that's so far removed from us, we don't feel a connection, and we can't perceive that. In a way, it's above us. Even it's not really above us. It's more within, without, rather than above us. So you take a quote like that from Kabir, and you know, if you know the law of seven, like you attune to the use of the number seven in different mystical literature, and the law of three, and in a way, having those keys helps one see the esoteric side of these different religions, how they support one another, and they're not contradictory. Okay, so, well, we've got off a little bit. I did want to try to bring us back, and I see we have a half hour left, Jim. I'm trying to do part four of my article series. And just to give you a bit of a background to it, the part one, the series is called The Origins and Nature of Consciousness. Part one was called The Heart Doctrine, and the main emphasis there is arguing that Western scientists and philosophers, we've made a fundamental mistake in assuming that the brain and the mind are exclusively in the head and that they somehow produce consciousness, and I call that the Head Doctrine. And then I explain how in all these different mystical teachings, they identified the true self with the heart rather than the head. And I go through different traditions explaining, quoting quotes to that effect. So that was part one, is establishing the idea that consciousness and the I experience within the human being originates out of the heart. Part two, then, was called the zero-point hypothesis. And here, it's arguing that connected to this heart, ultimately there is some type of zero-point element within the human being. And there's different meanings, different ways of trying to understand what's meant by the zero-point teaching or concept. Like, firstly, if we considered there to be a God spark or a divine spark or a spark of holiness within each human being, as is said in the mystical literature, then such a spark within the human being, in a way, it is a zero-point element. It is so small that it is beyond the level of material differentiation. So it's a zero-point element, because it's so small that you can't, it's beyond the level of material manifestation, so it can't be measured materially. So that's one meaning of the zero-point concept. And the other is that in Blavatsky, she describes how there are intelligences in higher dimensions, and when they channel their influence into material reality, their influences are based on what she calls zero-point foundations. So in a way, what zero points are like a portal, a transition from a lower level of material reality, and you kind of come to a zero point, and that zero point might open up into a whole other world on another plane of existence. So zero points can also be portals between levels of levels or dimensions. So that was part two of the series. Then part three was entitled Towards a Holographic Metaphysics of the Human Heart. And what it is based upon is a recounting of an experience by Yogananda in Autobiography of a Yogi, where Yogananda recounts one day his master said to him, "Nothing can satisfy your heart's desire." And he reached over and he tapped Yogananda over the heart. And what that does, that initiates Yogananda's subsequent experience. Now, the first thing that happens, he feels his consciousness stream out of his body like light, so that instead of his consciousness simply being confined to his body, he's aware of everything around him in the whole courtyard of the ashram. So it's like he's pervading a volume of space, and that is as described in lower states as samadhi. So his consciousness isn't confined to the body, but it's interpenetrating a volume of space, and he experiences things from all perspectives simultaneously. Like, it's not like he's seeing these things from one perspective, but rather it's like interpenetrating them. I remember having this kind of experience on LSD, Jim, when you would hug a tree, and the experience could be you could just feel the flow of the sap in the tree, and you could kind of blend with that tree. And I would say, even like experiencing that on the effect of LSD, I would say is like a legitimate like taste of what is meant by samadhi experience, where you blend with something. And you're not experiencing it from outside from one perspective, but it's like you feel it throughout itself. So anyway, in Yogananda's experience, his consciousness then expands, so he's aware of like the countryside around the ashram, and then he's aware of the whole continent, and then of the earth, and then of the solar system, and then of the galaxy, and then he kind of experiences what's called cosmic consciousness, where he experiences this kind of infinity of galaxies within his own being. And then he describes the uncreated void, which is beyond all of this. And that's described in the mystical literature as the ultimate prime source substance, is this kind of seeming void, which is the plenum. So Yogananda has this kind of vast experience of cosmic consciousness. And then all of a sudden, his consciousness is brought back into his body. And he makes a statement that, quote, "I cognized the center of the Imperium." Now, the word Imperium means the seventh heaven, because there are said to be seven heavens in accord with what we've been saying. "I cognized the center of the Imperium as a point of intuitive perception in my heart. Irradiating splendor issued from my nucleus to every part of the universal structure." So that experience of Yogananda, what it represents is his saying that somehow the whole of the larger universe is somehow reflected within the human heart. There's some connection between the deep levels of the heart and the whole of the outer universe. So part three of the article series was trying to look at this idea of the wholeness of reality, and how, like, what Yogananda experiences, like, this illustrates the ancient idea of the man being a microcosm of the macrocosm. That somehow within ourselves we embody the whole of the universe, and that we can know the universe through knowing ourselves. So part three then went into some of David Bohm and Carl Priebram, and it talks about the development of the holographic paradigm in modern psychology. But in the holographic paradigm in psychology, I quote Carl Priebram, a scientist famous for this, who said, there are no laser beams in the brain, meaning that the holography people didn't think there was an inner light source within the human being. And my point, one of the points in the article, is in mystical teachings, what mystics suggest is that there is a first point of supernal light. So if there were such a first point of supernal light, this would be the ideal basis for creating a human holograph. So in a way, mystical teachings provide one of the missing links in modern holographic theory in psychology, because the psychologists had the idea of holography, but they don't think there's an inner light source within the human being. So that was part three of the article series, Jim. Any kind of comments on my brief summary? Or it's kind of broad. That's kind of where the article series has been going.
Well, I just to put a comment on Priebram is that Priebram developed the holographic idea and theory related to consciousness and the mind and the brain, and Bohm developed with respect on a cosmological level, and then they became aware of one another's work, and that sort of prompted what was called the holographic paradigm development in the early 80s, and somehow that hasn't really had a huge impact in either psychology or in cosmology. As you say, this goes back to what I was talking about earlier about the dialogue between mystical and esoteric teachings and modern science. I mean, as you say, Priebram says, like in a hologram, you have to have a coherent light source that's essential to recreating the hologram. That's how you create the hologram. Like it's typically a laser, which is a coherent source of light, and then you use it to recreate the hologram and to create the virtual image. And he said, of course, his research showed that the mathematics, the Fourier transforms that underlie holography, actually are model what happens in the brain very well in terms of memory, and this led to his idea of a holographic, that the memory was stored holographically in the brain, that it wasn't in any one point in the brain or any structure, but it was distributed throughout the brain and then read out in a holographic fashion where everything's distributed through an entire area and all of the parts are in the whole and the holes in the parts. But then he says, okay, but you realize, of course, there's no holograph, there's no laser beam in the brain. And that's where the Hart doctrine provides a fundamentally different perspective on everything, and also hypothesizes, yes, there is a coherent light source, and it comes from the heart, and that's, I think that's quite revolutionary, and in a way, like, I think that overcomes the biggest block in the holographic paradigm as it applies to psychology, because I think we have to kind of fundamentally shift out of this, what I would say, what you argue is this mistaken assumption that underlies the head doctrine, that consciousness is generated by the physiological processes, structures in the brain, and by the brain's electrochemical activities. And we're arguing, no, that's not the case. That's the assumption, but that's wrong. And as I say, this idea of the light source existing within the heart is so fundamentally distinct and so different, and I think really provides a very different paradigm to study these things and try to develop the holographic paradigm.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. That really fills in, explains a little bit more. Her last had a cover. Yeah, that's good.
And then what's so interesting too, sorry, just to relate back to your description of what Yogananda is talking about in his experience of cosmic consciousness, he explains this exactly in, like, what he's describing is a holographic, non-local experience of cosmic consciousness where he transcends time and space. He sees galaxies being created out of everything being created out of light, which is a recurrent theme in the mystical literature, and what he describes is so entirely consistent with the perspective that's developed in the heart doctrine.
Yeah, it's amazing. He even in his experience of things, he experiences how material forms, as he penetrates their deeper structure, they dissolve back into the unifying light, and then he experiences them crystallizing out of the light and dissolving back into it, like simultaneously all of them. That is quite amazing experiences he describes. So anyway, Jim. So I'm going to just try to bring it back, and maybe I can read the title and abstract of what I'm trying to do as part four. It's supposed to be in July 1st, so I've got just a week to try to finish this up, and I'll read the abstract. Part four. I've entitled it "An Alternate Model of the Structure of Human Existence."
Don't take on anything too small.
Really.
Okay. That's good.
An alternate model of the higher dimensional structure of human existence is proposed based upon the archaic teachings of H. Blavatsky, the Secret Doctrine, and the Stanzas of Zen, and synthesized with emerging ideas in physics concerning the information processing and holographic paradigm. Specifically, it is proposed that the living entity within the human being is a monadic essence which exists within a sevenfold hyperspace dimension, or parent space. This monad, or God spark, has seven interior holes dug in space, and these have inherent spin as manifestations of the ceaseless breath with its circumgyrating motion. Well, I realize how it makes so much sense to me because I know what all these things refer to just hear this without explanation is difficult. But anyway, so what I'm suggesting is that it's an alternate model of the structure of human existence, and I'm saying a human being has like a God spark, but this God spark, see, it doesn't exist within four-dimensional space-time. Like, you can't find it in four-dimensional space-time. There's no use looking for a God spark outside of yourself. Okay, it exists. It is established in hyperspace, you see. So it's existent in this higher-dimensional space, which is the parent space out of which is created the four-dimensional world we experience. And I'm saying that this monadic essence, now I say it has seven interior holes dug in space. And to understand why I would say that about these seven holes dug in space, well, that leads into what is explained in the Secret Doctrine and how Blavatsky describes the cosmos as based upon seven zero-point centers, or holes dug in space. Okay, so I'm saying this monad is this little element, and it has interior holes dug in space. And these have inherent spin properties because they're manifestations of the ceaseless breath with its circumgyrating motion. See, in Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine, there are two main primordial substances. The eternal parent space, which represents the feminine principle, and there are said to be seven skins to the eternal parent space. And then the counterpart to that is the spiritual principle, embodying the spiritual principle, is the ceaseless breath. And the breath is related to spirit and motion and activity. So the ceaseless breath represents a spiritual principle, whereas the parent space represents a matter or the mother or material principle. So the ceaseless breath. See, before creation happens, the ceaseless breath pulses within the eternal parent space. It's like in the book of Genesis. The Spirit of God moves across the face of the waters. Well, that's, for Blavatsky, it's the ceaseless breath moving across the face of the eternal parent space. So it's the same analogy. So this monad, I'm saying, it's like a little element that has interior holes in it. And in modern physics, there's something called 11-dimensional M theory or 11-dimensional KK supergravity theory. There's different models of an 11-dimensional universe where they believe that every point in the four large dimensions, there's a seven-dimensional hypersphere existing at every point underlying familiar four-dimensional reality. And in modern physics, physicists are trying to understand the interior holes in these little elements down at these Planckian levels. These are beyond the Planckian level. So this idea of the monad as having these little interior holes is quite consistent with certain ideas that have emerged in modern physics. Okay, so I notice we got 10 minutes left, so I'll try to move through this a little bit. These spin properties manifest as spin energy or spinergy and act upon the sevenfold ethers of space to precipitate varied matters upon successive planes of being, hence to clothe the divine source emanation within spiritual, psychical, and material bodies. A multidimensional Star of David, the Tree of Life, and Jacob's Ladder, depicting four worlds of emanation, creation, formation, and made, illustrate such processes and the sacred laws of three and seven which govern them. The suns, or winks in the eye of self-existence. This is a term used by Blavatsky, which really appeals to me. Isn't that cool, Jim? Winks in the eye of self-existence. Can't you just see, like, one lifetime? Like, if you think of this kind of infinite being, I think of God as, like, this infinite being that lives through us all. And in from that perspective, each of us in our individual lives are kind of winks in the eye of self-existence. Yeah. It's a beautiful term.
I think of God as an, what did you say, as an infinite being? Or
as living through us all.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and he carries his comb in his breast pocket, just like I do. I love that in Gurdjieff when he talks about how people say that God, man is made in the image of God, and that they mean that he carries his comb in
his left pocket,
in his breast pocket like they do. So good. Sorry, love that about the winks of existence, because that's the different time scale, eh? Like, that's what it suggests, is that, you know, we could just be a blink.
Yeah, we could have blinks and winks and on different levels, because it's like a multi-leveled creative process. Yeah. Okay, so the suns, or winks in the eye of self-existence, which we are, expand and contract through their own hearts and selves within such a higher dimensional universe of unspeakable subtlety and beauty. Ultimately, every man and woman is a star. Seven holes dug in space are the basis for such a higher dimensional magic and existence, which serve as mini white hole, black hole processors weaving such webs of spirit and matter. This is an attempt to synthesize ancient mystical axioms with emerging concepts in holographic physics. So that's the abstract. And in a way that, what I'm trying to actually do is actually describe this kind of model that, you know, it's based on Blavatsky's secret doctrine of there being a monad in hyperspace, and this element actually has these seven interior holes dug in space. Because I then relate it all to the emergence of the holographic paradigm in modern physics, where they're talking about mini black holes and how mini black holes would be the ultimate information processors. Mm. And this concept has emerged in the information theory and quantum physics. And in a way, what's described by these researchers about these mini black holes is exactly analogous to what Blavatsky is saying in The Secret Doctrine. That these intelligences on higher planes of being, their influences are brought down and emerge from like zero point levels through these kind of portals in holes dug in space. So information can emerge out of such portals or be absorbed back into such a portal.
It's really intriguing how 125 years ago she anticipated things that are being, you know, written about today in physics. It's like it's so amazing, like how consistent her model is. It anticipates so many things that are now being recognized or being hypothesized.
Yeah, it totally is. Like what she says about this is probably like the most. I would say one of the most advanced and difficult concepts in her book, The Secret Doctrine, is how she says that the universe is founded upon these seven invisible points, the Leia centers. It's the newest ideas in holographic physics about how if you have, in the new models of physics, what you have is mini black holes which exist in an alternate, what they call it, anti-de Sitter space. It's a higher dimensional anti-de Sitter space, but what we could just call it hyperspace. So it exists in an alternative space dimension from the physical world. And in physics, in holographic physics, the idea that the activities of a black hole in hyperspace is rendered equivalent to the physics of information, energetic, and material processes which might surround that black hole in hyperspace. So, this is all very profound. And it helps to see the pictures of this. So I'm working away at this article. I notice we have 5 minutes left. I'm gonna try to send this to you this week, Jim. I hope when you get it, you might just. I know when I submit it, I need to submit it by Friday, and then they have different reviewers review it and see if they accept it, and then they offer commentary. So I would still have subsequent opportunity to revise the work. It's an attempt to formulate something. For me, this is like cutting edge. Like I've never really tried to formulate and articulate this in a way. They're such bizarre and otherworldly concepts that it's difficult to articulate. I'm not used to even talking about it. I mean, I've attempted at different times through this show, but it's difficult to do.
Yeah.
Anyways,
very complicated.
So anyway, I'll send that through you to you through the week, and sometime once the article is completed, I'll put all the pictures from the article up on the website so people can have a look at it, and we'll try to go through it. It really helps to see some of these pictures.
Yeah.
I noticed we're coming down to 5 minutes left. I had forgotten to mention my website at www.zeropoint.ca, and I've just most recently published a new issue of The Slugs, which I'm really pleased with, and I've put a lot of material from the new edition of The Slugs up on my site, because I just want to make the material available to people. Did you get a copy of it in, Jim, the Slugs?
No,
you hadn't yet. Yeah. Well, I thought once you have a copy and have some time, at a later point, we'll kind of pick up on the Slugs and go back to the Slugs, because especially the new edition, I'm so pleased with it, and the sections on the causes of war and such are... Gurdjieff's so profound. That book, Beelzebub's Tales, every time I read it, one uncovers new meanings and understanding.
Oh, by the way, too, just you mentioned that you were going to be on Evident Footprint on, was it Thursday night?
Yeah, this Thursday. Thank you. Good. Yeah,
and it's 10 o'clock Pacific time and 1 a.m. Eastern time, right? So it'll be Friday morning. To clarify, because we got people in different time zones, hopefully.
And that's on Station 2 at BBS. I should mention that, too.
Yeah.
Well, okay. We varied across the universe as usual. I see how we go over the same teachings over and over. You know, I think as people listen to the shows over time, you know, hopefully they'll go through some of the same processes we go through. Is as you work with the ideas and you hear it repeated and you try to formulate them in different ways, you know, it gradually helps to develop understanding in us. Okay, so thanks, BBS Radio. Thanks, Jim. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Thanks, Doug and Don.
Okay, goodbye.
Yep, bye.